2000 AD, 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. The look of 2000 AD. Borag Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to a supplemental episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. At the beginning of February, we had a fantastically successful 40th anniversary event, and it was an incredible day. Over 1,000 Squatstick Thargo, over 100 creators, all crammed into the Novotel in Hammersmith in London for a day of panels and signings and sketchings and just general fun. And all the feedback we've had has been absolutely wonderful. So thank you to everybody who came. Now, we appreciate that not everybody could get tickets, so we thought we would bring the event to you. So in between episodes of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, we're going to be bringing you panels recorded at the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. And this week, it's the look of 2000 AD. Now, writers and artists may grab the headlines, but letterers and designers have always been such a fundamental part of what makes 2000 AD what it is. And this panel with Piper, Ryan Hughes, Annie Parkhouse and Sam Boland goes behind the scenes with both the old school and the Young Turks to discuss the often overlooked arts of lettering and designing the galaxy's greatest comic, from the old days of paste and scalpels to modern desktop computers. Your host for the look of 2000 AD is Tom Muller.
Thank you, everyone. Welcome to the Look of 2000 AD panel. My name is Tom Muller. I'm your host for the next 45 minutes. And I'm joined here by the pantheon of 2000 AD design. So we have Pi Parr, who is a designer and illustrator who has been making 2000 AD look the way it looks for the last, 10 years on and off?
Since 2002.
Since 2002. Then we have the one and only Annie Parkhouse, who's basically been with 2000 AD and from the IPC days, and you have been an integral part, I'd say, into like the look and the lettering of 2000 AD, really putting the words into Judge Dredd's mouth. Yes? Yes, sort of. The one and only Ryan Hughes, designer, artist, illustrator, typographer, raconteur. Ryan has been a graphic designer and illustrator in comics since the mid-80s. Yeah. And he has obviously worked in 2000 AD, with 2000 AD, with Steve Cook throughout the late 80s and the 90s, kind of giving 2000 AD the look that it kind of currently still carries on. And then we have Simon Boland, who is a letterer for 2000 AD Judge Dredd magazine as well, and a load of other comics for Marvel and DC. So the first things first, I'm originally from Belgium, sorry. And I've never really grown up with 2000 AD like pretty much everyone here in this room. So I kind of, and I think this is a good way to kick things off, I brought with me my very first edition of a Dutch Judge Dredd comic. And as you can see, so basically people that can see is like, why does it say wet really big on the cover? Wet is Dutch for law. So it basically just says like, he is the law. But this is kind of like my introduction to comics and to Judge Dredd. And the thing is, as I grew older and I started to get into like the originals, as it were, I kind of started to notice like how badly lettered and designed this is. And basically, like they cut off all the work that you guys do and did and just replaced it with like just text balloons in Times New Roman, just random pasted lettering to like create big type and washing away. So that was kind of like my first impression of 2000 AD, that kind of universe and Dredd. So what was kind of your first impression of seeing 2000 AD and like that kind of impact that it had or didn't have on you? And how did that lead you to, actually, I wanna work, I'm gonna go into design or art and I wanna get into that kind of, I wanna work on that. I wanna help, I wanna design 2000 AD. Or I want to design in comics. And then being, obviously, in England, 2000 AD is kind of like the bastion of graphics and comics.
Okay. The first prog I bought was 700 and something. It was the one with Mean Machine jumping out of the cover by Richard Dolan, which is absolutely amazing. And I think it had Steve, is it Emerald Isle inside? So it was a guy getting annihilated by the chip gun. Uh-huh. It was just like, before that I'd been reading the Beano, so it was a bit of a...
Quite a step up.
It's a bit of a head fuck, yeah. And yeah, I always wanted to be an artist. But then all throughout school was pushed into design just because, you know, you can't draw things for a living, so why don't you do this?
Yeah.
And I kind of resisted it for many years and then just ended up doing it and found it I quite like it anyway. So I didn't know.
Yeah, that kind of like by accident.
Yeah,
almost.
It scratches the same itch, and I never thought it would. But yeah.
All right, that's interesting. And Annie, you were at already working with IPC, weren't you, back in the day?
Yeah, I started in 1970.
Yeah.
So I sort of eased into 2000 AD because I was working on Crisis and Revolver.
Yes.
So I can't say I had a moment where I'm going to be, you know, the wonderful letter
of
2000 AD. But so it continued. But what I think is interesting is the way comics have gone, like through IPC, from the old hot metal ephemera sort of comic to something that's really well produced and more of a publication.
Yeah.
So I think letterers have had to raise their game, and Simon definitely has raised the game. And I carry on, in a way, in a slightly looser,
old-fashioned style. But you kind of, like, and I think, Ryan, you as well, you went through that whole step change of doing everything by hand and actually having to be at the printers and doing, like, proper, like, quote-unquote old-school production, print production, to where everything now kind of happens digitally. I mean, you can quickly fix things. You know, so do you want to kind of talk about like how you kind of went through that evolution as it was?
From a production point of view?
Well, and I think also like from a design point of view, because obviously I think the way digital has kind of enabled a lot of things, like made things a lot easier. So I think in design as well,
I'm part of that generation that has one foot in the digital, one foot in the analog, and that's never ever going to happen ever again.
Yeah.
And it gives you a sort of unique perspective in that I don't think a lot of people who work purely digitally now realize how laborious and trouble prone it was. I mean, you first of all had to lay it all out on a board, and you had no idea what the colors were going to look like. So you would do an overlay, and you'd have a little color swatch book, and you'd look at the artwork and you'd think, well, maybe the logo will look good in that color. I don't really know. So you'd pick a color.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you would get a proof called a chromalin that was made from exposing the films that they were going to expose the plates from. So this was the last chance you got to actually correct anything that was dramatically wrong. At this point, of course, it was very expensive to change anything. It wasn't just like firing up Photoshop and changing a few colors. And so quite often you'd be looking at this chromalin and it would look awful, and you'd be going, it's great, isn't it? Just being sort of gritted teeth. But you kind of learn in public, and what we would do is we would produce mock-ups out of colored paper and gouache and all these analog effects.
Actually, like,
and that's what you would sort of show to the editor. So when I was designing all of the graphic novels that were coming out at about that time as well, that's how I would present it. And so you had that as a kind of guide to show to the printer. As the other question, the first issue of 2000 AD I picked up, and I came to it quite late, much to the disgust of my friends who were trying to get me into this. But the first one I picked up was, it had Judge Dredd coming out of a slab of Boeing on the cover by Brian Bolland. So that was issue 200 and something.
Okay.
But there was a certain aesthetic to those old 2000 ADs that were printed on newsprint that I actually thought really worked. And I think that was because the people who were doing it had so much experience in making the most out of the limited means of production. And when 2000 AD moved to full color, there was a kind of period where everyone was throwing every single font you can imagine on the cover and stretching type and all of these things that are very easy to do digitally. But you need a solid reason to do. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just throwing stuff on and seeing what happens. But the person who really sort of brought it all back on track was Steve Cook. And he was the art director at 2000 AD. Alan McKenzie bought Steve in. Mm-hmm. And Steve was responsible for really ironing all that out and making it shine and making it just look a whole lot more professional than it had been. And Steve was the person who got me involved, and that's where the custom fonts came from. Yeah. And
still
we collaborated.
Still in use as well.
Yeah,
Scott Meg and things like that.
Because, absolutely. I'm glad to see that they're still still out there. Yeah.
Because Steve came in and then he redesigned the logo, and then when editors switched, the logo would go, then it would come back, then it would be tweaked, it would be fine tuned.
Yeah, the kind of what people would really consider to be the classic logo, which is this one here, is Steve's
exactly,
logo.
Exactly. Yeah.
And with a sort of minor polish.
I did pretty much was take the drop shadow off.
Yeah. Always take drop shadows off. Yeah.
I kind of want to jump back and forth and go back to lettering, because you, Simon, have you ever done analog lettering, like actually hand lettering for 2000 AD?
Yeah. Not for 2000 AD. Okay. No, it's has it been digital for 15 years?
About 96, I think.
96. Okay, so that's kind of since digital really started to like grab hold. And
yeah, it started with Illustrator. Did you use Illustrator when you first started?
Freehand originally.
So just for that would actually be like quite interesting. Like what software, like how do you actually letter? Because traditionally you would letter on or over a layer over the art and like ink everything by hand, and like actually like where it starts to edge into like more calligraphy and like proper like letter construction. But then now that you're doing everything digital, you can just like you either use what, Illustrator or InDesign, or how do you kind
all three different people use different stuff. So Anna, you use InDesign, right?
I use InDesign, but I went from Illustrator and then I was asked to use Quark,
Okay.
which was a bit of a cartoon.
I'm still kind of trying to get over Quark.
Yeah.
Like much of the struggle that I have doing the Mega Collection books is making Quark files usable.
Yeah.
And it takes hours. Yeah.
So, yeah.
But so, yeah.
No, go ahead.
I forgot what I was going to say.
So the other thing, like, you know, talking about like all the production issues and kind of like, you know, especially the going from analog into digital, and then that kind of 90s digital explosion where everyone's basically like, oh, we can do all this stuff. But then is it a positive thing that you're working on a weekly, that you can kind of constantly keep experimenting and fixing? And does that give you a lot of freedom, or are you really bound by, say, the weekly deadlines and kind of, you know, for example, when Steve kind of set certain looks and kind of set the direction for a magazine, or like, you know, when you took over, does a weekly give you space to experiment in design, or do you have to kind of pick your battles?
Because of how quickly it turns over, you do tend to get sick of things quite quickly and change your mind about how to do it. So I went through several, not necessarily lettering, but ways to tie the stories together. Do I try and make each sort of 5 or 6 page section look like its own thing?
Yep.
Like, for example, Slane sitting next to Judge Dredd. Mm-hmm. If you choose one style of having the next prog line, it looks ridiculous the other one. So, and I was always sort of never, I don't know, I went back and forth about what to do about things like that.
And so with like, I was going through the 2000 AD book, and you see the kind of like the lettering and like especially sound effects in like almost every story, and every character has like their own kind of logo in iconography. Do you feel that when you're like, how does that kind of influence or like work, like how does that work in like, you know, the deadlines and the creativity where you actually have to like come up? Do you come up with like the logos and kind of like effects for characters, and does that get evolved into like, say, like the proper icons and brands for, say, like Rogue Trooper, ABC Warriors, that kind of stuff? Or is that kind of, is there a difference between quote unquote, the design department, lettering, which kind of involves a lot of graphics and type effects and that kind of stuff?
Well, I was brought up in IPC where I would design logos just on layout paper, and then they'd go up to the studio mm-hmm. and they'd make a professional job of it.
Yeah.
So I've never been a logo artist as such.
Okay.
When it comes to doing other things on artwork, it usually depends on the artist. The artist will actually ask me to do things.
I mean,
ABC Warriors for Clint Langley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was very definite about the look he wanted. So, you know, I don't go off on my own particularly, and
okay.
sometimes Matt reins you in if you do.
Okay, so
yeah, we had American Reaper as well. There was quite a lot of mucking around on that, wasn't there? Because he was like, I want the speech bubbles to be slightly see-through, and I want this to be white, and that to be
that was a nightmare for you.
Yeah. I ended up just individually mucking around with it for ages.
So working on the lettering, do you guys have a lot of like back and forth, we say, like the artists and the rest of the creative team, and like how they want to have things to look?
I prefer that.
Yeah? What about you, Simon?
Yeah. I prefer it when everybody's communicating.
Yeah.
You can't really read the mind of what the artist is intending. So, I mean, where possible, I'll try and get in touch with people before I start work.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Just to see if there's anything in particular that they're looking for
in
their work. Because at the end of the day, it's their work, and I'm just kind of finishing it off.
Right. Okay. I've never really had the chance to work on a weekly title. Like I work in comics as well, but I don't really do lettering as such, but I'm used to like monthly deadlines to get things out of the door. Like how does that kind of trickle down or condense into a weekly, especially like, you know, you've got like a lot of pages to letter, like actual stories. Like how do you kind of work within those deadlines and those constraints? Because I think I read an interview with you, Annie, like a while ago, where you said like back in the day you kind of like wait for pages to come in, kind of like there's not a lot to do, and then all of a sudden everything comes in and you basically have to scramble like in a couple of days to get everything done. A couple of hours.
I used to go into the office on a Friday. This was when I worked on Jet and Thunder.
Yeah.
And the courier would be waiting down in the foyer, and I was anxious that the ink was dry.
Uh-huh. You know?
So yes, lettering maybe 5 pages in about half an hour or as quickly as I could do it.
Okay.
I used to say I had electric scissors because that was when you had to cut the balloons out.
Uh-huh. And what about you, Simon? How has that changed, like doing everything digitally now? Do you still have like those last minute scrambles to get things out of the door, or has it kind of smoothed out everything?
No, I think it's worse now because I think the editors know that digitally you can work more quickly, you can correct stuff more quickly.
Yeah.
So you end up picking up a lot of slack on a deadline. Fridays are quite bad for American comics.
Yeah.
You probably know yourself. Yep. That's press day.
Yeah.
2000 AD, I think Matt runs it so well that I've never really had any kind of
That's
pressure on me from that.
That's very rare to hear that everything is kind of running well oiled.
I think Matt leaves a little bit of wiggle room too, because if somebody does drop out,
he lies to people about
things.
Editor should.
But yeah, that kind of goes back to what you were saying about crossing over to from sort of traditional media to the sort of digital stuff, is that everything, the time allotted for tasks get truncated down. Like you say, it's a weekly title, but when I was at 2008, sometimes I had to get it out in like 2 hours, the whole thing. So you get all the stuff from Annie and
then
go as fast as you could. Which isn't necessarily the best sometimes because you don't have time to think about stuff.
Do you have to go back and kind of like fix things in collected editions and stuff?
That's almost a difference with logo design. Once we started doing the graphic novels in-house again, because we stopped for many years, was changing the design of the logos for the characters inside so that they'd work on the book as well without having to do two versions stuff. Because they, you know, lots of square logos, for example, look great on a strip but bad on a book cover. Not always.
Yeah. But you kind of want to make sure that the thing that quote unquote lasts the longest on bookshelves has kind of like the look that you kind of intended from the start, perhaps. I want to kind of go back to like design and kind of like creating custom fonts and like the logo and that kind of thing. And 2000 AD has like had a very storied history in like how the logo changed over over the years. When do you think that a redesign is in order, Ryan?
So what was the question?
When do you think that a redesign of a magazine or a logo is
when
in order?
Or when or why?
When or why, yeah.
When or why? When is it in order? I think you know when it begins to look a bit tired.
Yeah.
And, you know, styles will change, fashions will change. And I think that a logo or a design that stays the distance, by and large, is not one that followed any specific trend to begin with.
Right, yes.
It's a bit like if you dress yourself up in, you know, purple flares, you're going to go out of date very fast.
Yeah.
Whereas if you tend to make it a bit more clean and classic, you're probably going to last. So I think that only time can tell really what design actually has that longevity. But I find it interesting that the Co-op have just bought back their old Sixers logo, which I remember.
And I think
that there's this kind of willingness to redesign and redesign sometimes means that it's not always a move in the right direction.
True.
Quite often, as a graphic designer, working on properties that have been around a long time, I think quite often what you've got to do is preserve and unearth the essence of what made the original logo work and just refine that and throw away a lot of the extraneous effects that have accumulated over the ages. So sometimes there's a job where there isn't, it's a new character, it's a new magazine, you have a vague idea of the audience that it's trying to address and the tone of the stories, and those are the kind of starting points that you use when you're thinking about the design.
Yeah.
At other times, when you're working on, say, a Batman logo, for example, when I did all the Valiant logos, I sort of went back to the original logos and tried to unearth some essence of the character or the logo, so that people coming to this afresh would think that this is a contemporary piece of design and a brand new comic, but the people who remembered the characters
it
from before
back,
would also have their fancy tickled and want to pick it up as well. And I think that one of the problems we have in comics is that it can become a bit of a nostalgia fest. And there's this, I mean, I love old comics as much as the next comic geek, but as a designer coming into comics, because I came... most of my work was not comic based. I mean, I worked in, I worked as a magazine designer and I worked in advertising and I worked as a record sleeve designer back in the day when there were record sleeves. And what I always tried to do is bring some of that sort of wider cultural experience into comics, because the problem that I found with comics is that most of the people who were in comics just looked at other comics, and so it tended to be quite a closed shop. And it was quite easy to bring things in from outside of comics, and everyone would go, "Wow, that looks like an amazing fresh piece of graphic design." Whereas if I'd done that exact same thing on a record sleeve,
they'd
go
like, "That was so last year."
Exactly. So you just have to sort of port things in from outside.
Yeah.
And I think that's the essence of 2000 AD as a comic, is that it was, when it began, it was so much more aware of punk and music and everything that was going on in cinema. It wasn't a comic that just focused on comics.
Yeah.
And that's why it was so fresh. So I tried to have that broader cultural input that I tried to, I still try to bring it into my comics.
Yeah.
But
no,
now that I'm not 18 anymore, I have no idea what the kids are listening to. So it's
I think that's... yeah, I can completely agree. I kind of try to do the same thing, like to keep things fresh in comics, you kind of have to look outside and kind of keep it like contemporary.
And not,
in that way.
And not just at other graphic design outside comics, just at culture and
music,
and life,
arts,
and
architecture, anything. But then I think exactly for a magazine like 2000 AD, it's always been like very current and kind of sometimes a bit forward thinking as well, with like, you know, the political satire is now kind of going like, I read that like 10 years ago in like a Judge Dredd comic or something. But do you, like, to kind of keep that ball going, as you, like, you know, as editors change and creative teams change and like, you know, design teams change, do you then have, is your impulse, like, for example, you took over from Steve, like, from like what he and like what you guys basically in tandem created throughout the 90s, do you get the urge to kind of come in and
that's right, like, it is difficult because you do immediately want to put your stamp on it, and then kind of changing it too soon after that I think is a mistake, because you've I did some absolutely awful things in the first 2 years though. Yeah. Probably longer than that.
These are all changed in
the collections. I don't design 2000 anymore. I sort of quit a couple of years ago, but the guys have left it how it was, which is nice.
do you then think, oh, this is nice, my stuff still works, or do you go like, yeah, guys, it's time to kind of change it up?
Yeah, I suppose when I look at it now, it's not quite how I'd do it. So maybe they should do it their way.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm
trying to stay out of it now.
So a slightly controversial question. Do you think 2000 AD is still relevant, the design? Or do you think it's kind of become stuck into its own kind of look and myth and
history? I think it's secondary to the stories and the art, really.
Yeah.
I always kind of felt that as long as you're... Don't really know where to go with that.
So. Difficult question. I think that's why Owen asked me to host this panel, because I was like, I didn't grow up reading it. I know Dread, Slain, ABC Warriors, and that's kind of like where it ends for me. So I kind of, when I recognize 2000 AD wherever I see it, because it's very, you know, you've got like the core colors, that's never changed. But then I kind of think, and you know what Ryan was just touching on, like you, to keep things fresh, you constantly need to evolve. And when I look at, say, very old magazines and like, you know, when it started to what it's now, you kind of, in my eyes, I kind of see things kind of evening out, and it becomes kind of comfortable in what it is, whereas it used to be I got this sense of like it's really angry and kind of wants to say something. And
it's middle-aged like us.
Maybe, yes. But when I was growing up, when I was like, you know, when I read that first Judge Dredd comic, I kind of got the sense like, oh, am I old enough to read this kind of thing? It's like, it's a bit like dangerous. And I think that's kind of what for me always appealed to like what 2000 AD was for me. So I think as like any design, do you kind of, when does it feel stale? Or like, you know, middle-aged like us, we kind of like need to keep prodding at things, don't you think?
Well, there's a middle-aged market too, of course.
I know, but there's like this sense where you kind of like, don't you want to keep things, because the middle-aged market will grow older and you kind of need to keep that fresh blood coming in. And like, you know, styles change and design changes, all that stuff. So do you want to, don't you think that needs to be reflected into like design of comics and especially something like 2000 AD, which is like available everywhere, and that can kind of make things look really interesting? Dun, dun, dun. Okay, next question, next question. What else do I have? So talking about like all the different characters and the stories that have been published throughout 2018, like magazine and whatever, how do you keep like, is there a subliminal kind of thought process where everything kind of needs to connect to each other? So for example, the Slain logo is like completely different from Dread, ABC Warriors, Rogue Troopers, sorry. Is there like, as like, you know, when you're designing logos and kind of the magazine, are you thinking about everything needs to have like a very specific look, or everything needs to have a 2000?
This is what I was saying earlier. I kind of constantly switch between the two of trying to connect the whole thing into one overarching look, or trying to make each 5-6 page section like an individual comic. And I tried both ways and wasn't. I kind of really settled on the latter, really, just because the variety of the art and the types of stories lend themselves to being sort of more specialized. Because if you put something too futuristic on a Slain story, it looks
it's
ridiculous.
Not gonna work.
Exactly.
So,
And even more so, like the graphic novels, you know, it's nice to really, because that's the thing, because 2000 is an anthology. You do have to think about anything, like the cover logo, for example, has to work with whatever art you sit on it. So you can't, I tried not to go too mad on things that I did with that.
Right.
but that's when it's nice when you get to do a graphic novel, because it's just the one thing. You can really specialize it and personalize it, you know, when you do it well.
So, Ryan, when you were doing Dan Dare, were you also like designing the stories and like doing the logos and the lettering, or was that something
I
like overheard you when you said, like, mentioned to Annie that she might have lettered?
I don't think you did. I can't remember. It's too long ago.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay, moving swiftly on. I think, 2000 AD had just started. Dan Dare was actually in Revolver, not 2000 AD.
Yeah.
And so at that point, Fleetway were trying to launch, you know, adult comics in this kind of post-Watchmen, post-Dark Knight comic boom.
Yeah.
And they were repackaging a lot of the older material.
Mm-hmm.
Steve designed 2000 AD, and I did sort of the odd logo and everything for 2000 AD, but I didn't. I worked on Revolver and Crisis designing those, and then some of the graphic novels that 2000 AD were putting out. So that was the sort of division of the labor, if you like, between me and Steve. And what was the question?
The question was, like, because you do design as well as, like, you know, actual...
Oh, as well as the comic. Well, I tell you what I like about a lot of the comics that I buy now is that you very much get the impression that a Dan Clowes graphic novel is designed by Dan Clowes, and you know, an Adrian Tomine graphic novel is designed by Adrian Tomine.
Yeah.
So they're these complete works.
Yeah.
You know, every aspect of it is an expression of the creator.
Yeah.
And I think that when you work the opposite way, so you tend towards a kind of blandness where everything looks very similar and a kind of house style. And for me, growing up with 2000 AD, Marvel had this kind of... I mean, I'm slightly more enamored of them now, but back then it just looked very generic.
Yeah.
Whereas 2000 AD had this clash of styles, people working in very different styles, sometimes on the same character, you know, from week to week, which I thought was always... a plus, not a minus. And so now I think the graphic novel collections that we see coming out are so much better designed than they were back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the day, they were kind of designed... Quite often the artist or the writer would have no input whatsoever into what the graphic novel looked like. It would just be done sometimes by an in-house team who probably... didn't even read comics. So they had a kind of generic comic look.
Yeah.
And what I always try and do with a graphic novel or a logo design is you have to, first of all, know who the artist is going to be. Sometimes you can't because you're working on a monthly comic and the artist will change. So you just have to do a standalone logo. But if you're working on something where you have some kind of relationship with the creative team, you've got to articulate what they are trying to do somehow.
You know, shape it.
Is this a sort of rom-com romance? Is this a mean and gritty future crime thriller?
Yeah.
You know, those are the kind of conversations you have, and that's what you try and articulate throughout, because the design is not just the logo.
Yeah.
It's the typography. It's the page layout.
Yep.
It's the, you open it up, you know, what does those introductory pages look like? All of those set the scene for what's about to come next.
Yeah.
So you're kind of the window dressing for the main event, and you don't want to overshadow the main event.
True.
You want to sort of be the compare that sort of gives the best big up.
Yeah.
And, you know, then the creative team take over. So you've kind of set the scene and lured the people in so that then these guys can show you your fireworks. And I felt when I was starting out in comics that a lot of comics I was put off by reading because they looked really generic.
Yeah.
And because I was coming from sort of music design and things like that, I wanted to sort of bring a bit more of that when I... got into comics and I realized that it was a much richer and more varied world than I'd originally thought. I wanted to help bring it to a wider market and not put other people off like I had been put off. So, you know, just to bring in an audience that would be interested in this stuff.
Yes, agreed. But on that note, lettering, for example, they always say, like, you know, good design is invisible. Good lettering should also be invisible in a way that it doesn't, like, you know, it kind of helps the reader get the story. But as a letterer, you kind of want to imbue it with your own personal style, kind of thing. Like, every letter has like his or her approach, and you kind of want to go like, I mean, over the years now, letters are getting credits on comics, on covers, on, like, you know, just credit boxes on anthologies and everything. Do you, as a letterer, where do you draw the line where you become, want to be like as invisible as possible and serviceable to the story and actually like design your own lettering typefaces, for example, that you then adapt for each and every story? So do you design your own typefaces based, like, if you're lettering Judge Dredd or if you're lettering Slain or anything else, if you're doing like different dialogues, how do you approach those kind of, that mix?
I think that's one more for Simon than me.
Simon.
You do get asked a lot of the time
to
use a lot of different fonts, mm-hmm. different characters with a different font.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of that, personally. I think the more fonts that you put in on a page, the more messy it's going to look.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any need for, you know, four or five different dialogue fonts in a comic.
Yeah.
It's very rarely in 2000 AD you'll see anything away from the standard font, I think.
Do you remember when Daleks used to speak in those kind of diamond-shaped letters? Wasn't that brilliant?
And no one could read it.
And ABC Warriors, where Clint wanted all
those different exactly. shapes. Yeah, exactly. So it's stuff like that. As a letter, you kind of, your first thought is this needs to be legible, but then at the same time, editors or like the writers or the artists are like, no, this guy needs to sound like this in my head, so it needs to look all like diamond shaped or square or like blips and dots and whatever.
Do the Daleks still speak that way?
I have no idea.
Does anybody know? Do Daleks still speak in Dalek? Yes.
How much time do we have left? 5 minutes? Do we want to take questions? Does anyone have questions? Yes.
I was really interested in what you were saying about the old analog way of doing things, particularly cutting up speech bubbles. And I'd never considered, like, when I got my copy of 2000 AD, that somebody had frantically cut up the speech bubbles. And I just wanted to know sort of a bit more about that world, really, of old school and how basically, what was the process? So you cut up the speech bubble, then what, you know?
You lettered on patch paper or tacky back paper, which was a very nice surface. It also had the advantage of different artists would use different qualities of paper. And I don't know whether paper was at a shortage, you know, in the early days. Baxendale would use wallpaper. And, of course, it would be lumpy and bumpy, you know, so patch paper was really useful for doing that. Also, it was correctable. You could strip it off. And sometimes if they wanted lettering changes, I mean, obviously nothing digital, you'd have to strip it off and re-letter it or resizing it for annuals and things like that. So it had lots of advantages. So, yes, it used to be you got the artwork, you did the lettering on the patch, you cut it out, and then you put in the tails by using graphic white. Then later they started using art film. So you're doing exactly the same process, but you're doing it on art film instead.
So art film is kind of like a...
Like an animation like film, an animation. But it meant that the art was left absolutely clean, yeah.
So are you painting the... I mean, how do you get the actual speech bubble if it's on a film?
Well, you just have a sheet of film on top of the artwork and then you cut out your balloons and stick them on the film and then draw the tails and wipe them in from the back, usually. same way as colouring used to be done that way too, colouring on the back of the film.
And I suppose now it's kind of Photoshop and
or whatever program you want to use, yes. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Anyone else?
Hi, just to follow on from the sort of analog digital thing, when you mentioned one or two advantages of doing the speech thing, do you think in general, with respect to the whole of the 2000 AD, do you think anything else has been sort of lost in the move from analog to digital? I mean, you can think of things like, you know, CDs or digital effects in films, and people are now, you know, with the perspective of maybe 10 to 20 years of looking back, there are certain things you think actually they're not quite as good, or you've lost some kind of something, I don't know, essential or ephemeral that's somehow been lost. Is there any aspect of 2000 AD that you think has gone that way?
Well, I miss seeing the original artwork. You know, I just get JPEGs now. And that's a shame. As far as the look's concerned, it's just different.
I think a tool is only, you know, the tool is only as good as the person who's using it. And I think that the more versatile the tool, the more easy it is to abuse it. And I think that's what happened in the early days of digital. But I wouldn't go back. I can just remember the hours in the dark room doing copies on a copy camera, and you designed an album and you had to do 10 adverts for, you know, Smash Hits and The Face or whatever. And each one was a slightly different size, and it would be days of work doing this. Now it's just save as, you know, it's 5 minutes work. So it's so much easier.
Yes, we didn't have an undo in those days either.
No. You had to send out for typesetting. Do you remember that? You'd get galley proofs, and then you'd have to copy check them, and then you'd send it back again.
I remember having to phone the printer to say, can you chip out that F and make it look like a T or something?
Oh, do you remember making the corrections with a scalpel at the 11th hour?
On film.
I never did it on film.
I did it on film with sellotape.
That's ninja stuff.
Replacing a letter.
Yeah. You'd have like a full stop on the end of your scalpel, and then you'd get some spray mount, and it would disappear into the bin. And you would...
I think I could do a full stop.
Going from again analog to digital, how did you guys make that transition to digital? Did you teach yourself, because you guys were kind of growing up without YouTube?
When I started work at 2008, it was kind of half and half, or at least starting to go digital. So all the files were in Quark Express, all the lettering files and stuff. But then they were sent out to another company who made the PDFs for some reason. And I'd just moved from a company who'd brought everything in-house. So that was the first thing we did, was just sack that off to save money, basically. But I mean, before that, I sort of started graphic design after that was over, really. I think my first ever job had something, a machine that made film, but I literally know nothing about it.
Steve Cook and I, we both decided that we should probably investigate this new computer design thing that everyone was talking about. So we both bought exactly the same kit. Okay. Two reasons. One is that it was cheaper if we bought two of everything, but two, the second one is we could phone each other up when we didn't know what was going on. So we both had a 2CI, which I think had a massive 8 megabytes of RAM. And I would do these covers I was designing the Invisibles, I think, which Sean Phillips was doing the covers for. These PsyQuests would arrive, and you would load up the image, and you could basically go off and have lunch and come back, and while it was saving onto your PsyQuest. And then, of course, there wasn't any there was ISDN, and then there was sort of digital delivery, but you had to FedEx these PsyQuests to New York and back, and they're notoriously fault prone, and sometimes it would take two or three tries before. I mean, the patience that they showed getting me to design all this stuff, it would have been so much easier for them to do it in house, but they, you know, I was thankful that, you know, they asked me to do all this. But now it's just, you're on the phone or you're on Skype. Yeah. Okay, there you go, have a look at it now, made your correction. Oh yeah, thank you. So you know, they might as well be in the next room.
Yes, that's made a huge difference, because I was lettering boards for DC, and the art was done in Croatia. No, it was done in Orkney, and then it came to me. I lettered it, and then it was FedEx to New York. But I was also doing work from Croatia for Dark Horse in California. Cumbersome or what?
So digital is good.
Yes. Gets us more work as well.
A very quick question. At what point did the masters move from being to separate out the lettering from the original artwork? Because obviously in the original days you would, you know, put down your speech bubbles and so forth actually onto the artwork master and then take that off and photograph it and do what you need to do. But obviously that doesn't seem to happen nowadays. I presume they keep the art entirely separate from the lettering so that you can reuse, and you know, you get graphic novels without complete panels rather than panels with areas removed for the logo type.
You want to know when?
Yeah,
when
roughly
it was
when.
Stopped.
Obviously, in 2002, that was.
That was all lettered digitally then. Yeah. And I think when were you saying 96 or something?
Yeah, it's about 96. Yeah.
Was the artwork fully digital at that point?
We scan stuff to a digital file, and then that sort of sits behind the lettering on a separate layer.
Gotcha.
But going back, there was always a separation. I mean, you had a colour separation anyway, but you had a black separation because printing wasn't always that reliable. And I'm from Carlisle, and an awful lot of comics were printed at Carlisle Web Offset because they had the best black that could be found in the country. And I mean, it was, you know, their separations were just so good.
So you were actually lettering on the black sheet rather than on the original artwork?
No, I was
lettering
on the artwork, but but there'd always be the black as part of the separation.
Yeah.
So it depended on the quality of the ink and the quality of the paper.
Okay.
Anyone else? Then we shall wrap it up with this. Thank you, everyone, for coming to our little panel, and round of applause for our guests.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that, Earthlitz. Sorry about any sound issues. This was, of course, being recorded in front of a live audience, so not everybody's microphone technique is perfect, but I hope you at least got the gist of this panel. An absolutely fascinating insight into the behind-the-scenes work that goes on in creating the galaxy's greatest comic. Join us next week for a regular episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, and make sure you tune in 2 weeks' time for another amazing panel from the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. Splendig Vertrig.
Dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.